we know the wind's going to be in our face. We don't know whether it's going to be category 3, 4, or 5.
So, which storm is he talking about? Pick your pick.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Certainly is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF, amongst other fine terrestrial affiliates. And then there's those folks who stream us on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for, I want to say another thrilling episode. It's kind of a creepy, scary episode today, perhaps, of the Brad Blog. Would you say, Desi Doyen?
I would agree with you on that. I prefer things to be slightly less creepy, scary, etc.
Given this monster lurking off the East Coast. No, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. In this case, I'm talking about Hurricane Florence, although President Donald Trump said on Tuesday that his administration is, quote, totally prepared as Hurricane Florence barrels towards the Carolinas and Virginia and now Georgia, predicting to reporters that the storm would be, quote, tremendously big and tremendously wet. Oh, he's a stable genius, isn't he? Trump said the government is, quote, sparing no expense to ensure American safety, though separately it was revealed on Tuesday night that his administration had recently moved some $10 million out of FEMA from FEMA's recovery funds over to ICE's immigration detention funds. Nonetheless, he said, we are totally prepared. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on Tuesday, citing his administration's work on Puerto Rico, which killed nearly 3,000 Americans at the same time, to become the worst natural disaster in U.S. history, at least in more than a century. He quoted that success at the same time that he was reassuring Americans were totally prepared. He said that Puerto Rico was, quote, an incredible unsung success. Again, despite some 3,000 Americans killed in that disaster. Trump continued the remarks on Wednesday morning, tweeting that, quote, we got A pluses for our recent hurricane work in Texas and Florida and did an unappreciated great job in Puerto Rico, even though an inaccessible island with very poor electricity and a totally incompetent mayor of San Juan.
This makes me concerned that perhaps he's not actually listening to anything anybody tells him or briefs him on.
Oh, no. Don't worry about that. He said in that tweet, quote, we are ready for the big one that is coming.
Oy.
Don't you worry yourself, your pretty little self there, Desi Doyen. The mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, responded to Trump's comments on Tuesday about Hurricane Maria as, quote, despicable. We will be joined shortly by a 30-year Weather Channel veteran to discuss not just the facts on Florence and why it has become such a monster storm, but as many as nine, count them now, nine major storms named and otherwise currently brewing across the globe, including at least six surrounding the U.S. right now in one way or another. But first, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell used the Florence storm as a metaphor for what Republicans may be up against in the November 6 midterms this year in the U.S. Senate.
You know, we've got a storm headed toward the coast, and we know the wind's going to be in our face. We don't know whether it's going to be Category 3, 4, or 5. Almost every election, 2 years into any new administration, the party of the presidency loses seats. And so we know this is going to be a very challenging election. On the Senate side, a bunch of races that are dead even, Arizona, Nevada, Tennessee, Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and Florida. All of them too close to call, and every one of them like a knife fight in an alley. I mean, just a brawl in every one of those places. I hope when the smoke clears that we'll still have a majority in the Senate.
Yes, he hopes, and that's why they're trying to push through Judge Brett Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court justice as quickly as they possibly can. By the way, Senator McConnell, that's Nevada, not Nevada, where they have a very tight Senate race there this November with Republican Dean Heller running for re-election and may have some serious troubles this year. We will soon find out in less than 2 months. Nonetheless, Rhode Island voters went to the polls on Wednesday for the final federal primary election before this year's midterms on November 6. Mark it down, that's November 6. And on Thursday, New Yorkers will head to the polls for their state and local primaries, including closely watched races for governor and attorney general, among other things, which that will, as of Thursday in New York, that will officially end this year's primary season once and for all. On Tuesday, however, New Hampshire voters cast their votes in the year's penultimate federal primary elections. And I'm happy to report that the state, which votes on hand-marked paper ballots and even hand-counts them in about 40% of their towns, they reported few, if any, problems so far for voters on Tuesday beyond larger-than-expected turnout in many places. We'll see if things change as far as problem reports go and as numbers are finalized in the coming days. But yes, the turnout was much heavier than usual in the Granite State on Tuesday, including in a number of college towns. That's good news for a number of reasons, including the fact that New Hampshire Republicans recently passed a law to make it more difficult for college students to register to vote in New Hampshire, though that law is currently facing a court challenge right now, and it won't officially kick in until 2019 if the court allows it to stand. But according to the Valley News in Hanover, college towns in New Hampshire saw heavy turnout as get-out-the-vote drives and strong feelings about Donald Trump drove many voters to the polls. Hanover is home to Dartmouth College and saw a 25% increase over the 2016 presidential primary, according to the town clerk.
Wow.
That turnout was more than double the number of voters who participated in the last midterm primary elections in 2014 back there in Hanover. Durham, home to the University of New Hampshire, saw more than twice the average primary turnout between 2008 and 2016, according to its town administrator, Todd Selig, who said in a news release, that, quote, the numbers this year simply blew away our historical averages. Those numbers likely come as encouraging news to Democrats, I would suspect, heading into the November 6 general election. Secretary of State Bill Gardner in New Hampshire predicted 90,000 people would take a Democratic ballot on Tuesday, which would have amounted to a record midterm turnout. Instead, as of today, closer to 122,000 voters cast a vote in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, far higher, about 30% higher than Gardner, who, by the way, more than he's predicted, Gardner has been the Secretary of State in New Hampshire for 40 years. Seriously. He's been the state's Secretary of State since 1976. And he still didn't see this apparent Democratic wave of voters coming on Tuesday. Predicted a record 90,000, turned out to be 122,000. Officials in other communities like Lebanon and Londonderry reported increases in turnout compared to 2 years ago. Londonderry town manager Kevin Smith said in a tweet that the turnout was, quote, much higher than the turnout seen in 2016's primary. And remember, those comparisons to 2016 in some of these towns, that was a presidential primary year when Bernie Sanders ran and won in New Hampshire against Hillary Clinton in the nation's first in the nation primary. We'll see if the high turnout numbers continue into November. But yeah, as to the reported results from Tuesday night, former Senator Molly Kelly, State Senator Molly Kelly, defeated former Portsmouth Mayor Steve Marchand to win the Democratic gubernatorial nomination on Tuesday to become the 15th woman nominated for governor this year, which is a record. There's also, I believe, more than 100 women running for the U.S. House who won their primaries for the U.S. House this year. That's also a record. Kelly said strong Democratic turnout should send a message to Governor Sununu that voters want someone who will put the people first, not corporate special interests. She's a five-term state senator. She frequently emphasized her experience as a single mother who raised three children while putting herself through college. She will now face the very popular first-term Republican Governor Chris Sununu, who ran unopposed. Sununu is the largely purple Granite State's first GOP governor in 15 years. In a very crowded primary on both the Democratic and Republican side for the U.S. House, Executive Counselor Chris Pappas won an 11-way race for the Democratic nomination in the 1st Congressional District, where Democrat Carol Shea Porter's decision to step down after four non-consecutive terms resulted in a swarm of candidates seeking to replace her. Literally, she has gone back and forth with the same Republican candidate, winning and then losing and then winning and then losing and then winning and then losing and then winning that seat for the past decade. But this year, she is stepping down. Chris Pappas is the winner in that 11-way race. Among the 11 Democrats running for that nomination was Levi Sanders, the son of the Vermont senator and former presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders. However, Levi came up short on Tuesday. The district, first district, which covers the eastern half of the state, was once a reliable Republican stronghold, but it has flipped back and forth over the past 10 years. In 2016, however, even though it went to a Democrat, the district there ended up backing Donald Trump in 2016. So this is a very interesting district and perhaps the swingiest of swing districts in the country.
Yeah, it's really dramatic to hear about that.
Yep. One of the Democratic contenders for the nomination was former Obama administration official Maura Sullivan. She raised more money than the other 10 candidates combined. But she failed to win, even with all of that money. So it's not necessarily money, it seems, that is winning these races for a lot of these Democrats this year.
No, it seems to be completely, if I may say, based on voter engagement and voter turnout. And this is something that we've seen over and over and over again in midterm elections and general elections, that big turnout is essential. The margin of turnout has to be larger than the margin of suppression or the margin of dirty tricks in order to make a difference for these candidates.
Pappas, who won the Democratic nomination in the first district, is an openly gay former state lawmaker. He had the backing of the state's two Democratic U.S. senators, said he was proud that most of the money he had raised came from within the state. and pledged that his campaign will be about decency, unity, and progress. That response about the money coming from in-state seems to have been a swipe at Maura Sullivan, who outraised everyone, raising more money than the other 10 candidates combined. But she was criticized for being new to the state. She just moved there about, I was going to say an hour ago, but it might as well be, about a year ago. Criticism about voting in general after she acknowledged not voting in several recent elections.
Oh, boy.
That's not a good look for a Democrat. On the GOP side of that race, a black former police chief backed by the Trump administration won the Republican nomination in that toss-up first congressional district. Eddie Edwards was endorsed by Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani, and he defeated six Republican opponents. Edwards is the second African-American to be nominated to a U.S. House seat in New Hampshire. Seven Republicans competed for a chance to face Democratic U.S. Rep. Annie Kuster in the second of two congressional districts in New Hampshire. She, for her part, faced no opposition in the Democratic primary. As of today, it's a very close race for that GOP nomination, with the unofficial first place finisher being Steve Negron, who's up by less than 300 votes, although the New York Times has called it for Negron today. He's up just 300 votes over second place Stuart Levinson in what is considered otherwise to be by Cook Political Report to be a competitive, if, quote, likely Democratic district this fall. We will keep our eyes on that race, because if there are to be any disputes about results, at least in the federal races or the big races, that's likely where it'll happen, as far as I can tell. And one more story here related before we get to Florence and Olivia. Yes, another storm threatening the U.S. this week, and many more actual storms with my guest today. In New Hampshire, a 27-year-old Afghan refugee has ousted a four-term incumbent in the Democratic primary for a seat in the New Hampshire legislature. That's pretty cool. The Concord Monitor reports that Safia Wazir beat District 17 State Rep Dick Patton, who argued that her refugee background would hurt her campaign. Well, that's nice, State Rep. But nonetheless, Wazir pulled out Tuesday's primary victory by highlighting her years of community activism and dedication to education and family issues. If Wazir beats Republican Dennis Soucy in November, she would become the first refugee in the state to hold public office, according to Secretary of State Bill Gardner. Her family fled Afghanistan in 2007 as the Taliban consolidated power. She arrived in Concord that same year, and this year it looks like she will become a New Hampshire state legislator in November. Pretty cool. Wazir, by the way, says she would focus on Medicaid expansion and enacting paid family leave in New Hampshire. So a progressive refugee from Afghanistan will soon, it looks like, likely be sitting in the New Hampshire state legislature.
Very cool.
Cool indeed. All right. Well, enough of that good news of people expressing themselves democratically at the ballot box. Back to the bad news. As Florence threatens the East Coast and eight other storms loom across the globe in record warm waters, weather guy Guy Walton joins us next on the Bradcast to talk about it all and more. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast.
It's gonna rain, I can see it. Soon it's gonna rain, I can tell.
Yeah.
Soon it's gonna rain.
That may be our bumper music understatement of the year. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. People who thought that they were relatively safe from the onslaught of Hurricane Florence finally began boarding up. Oh, take your time, guys, according to the AP. And Georgia's governor has also now declared a state of emergency in his state as uncertainty over the path of the monster storm spread worry along the southeastern seaboard. Closing in, now slowly closing in, with terrifying winds of around 125 miles per hour as we go to air, and potentially catastrophic rain and storm surge. Florence is expected to blow ashore, at least as of now, on Saturday morning along the North Carolina-South Carolina border, according to the National Hurricane Center. Though each day that we have been covering this storm, its landfall prediction has gotten later and later, indicating, at least to my non-meteorological eyes, a storm that is slowing down, not its wind speeds necessarily, but the speed at which it is moving, which means even worse news for those in its path. But what do I know? We'll talk to my guest about that in a moment. While some of the computer forecasting models are currently conflicted, the latest projections, more or less, seem to show the storm shifting somewhat southward in a way that suddenly put more of South Carolina in danger and has imperiled Georgia too. North and South Carolina and Virginia declared emergencies earlier in the week. The main utility companies in the Carolinas today warn that up to 75% of customers could lose power in this storm, some for weeks. For weeks! As of Wednesday evening, more than 10 million people are now under hurricane warnings and watches in the Carolinas and in Virginia, according to the National Weather Service, with almost 2 million under warnings to evacuate the coast. Those numbers are likely rising today, with Georgia now in the target zone as well. All I can do at the moment is urge those of you who listen to and or follow our president, who announced on Tuesday that the federal government is, quote, totally prepared for this storm. All I can urge is to please ignore him and prepare yourself for this. After all, he made those same comments at the very same time that he praised his administration's, quote, incredible unsung success for their response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico last year at this time, after which nearly 3,000 Americans died, more than Hurricane Katrina or even 9/11, and power remained out on the island for nearly a year. The Hurricane Center's projected track, at least at this hour, seems to have Florence hovering over the southern North Carolina coast starting on Thursday night or so before blowing ashore over the next day or two or three. That, according to experts, could punish a longer stretch of coastline and for a longer period of time than previously thought. University of Miami hurricane researcher Brian McNulty describes the current trend as, quote, exceptionally bad news since it smears a landfall out over hundreds of miles of coastline. Well, we seem to excel at exceptionally bad news around here these days on the Bradcast, and this storm looks like it will give us no respite from that. But Florence isn't the only thing, nor even the only storm we all may need to be worried about at peak hurricane season in a global warming-fueled, climate-changed world. Joining us to help shed a bit of light over this dark news today, maybe, we'll see, is Guy Walton, or Weather Guy, as I know him from the Twitters. He's a 30-year Weather Channel veteran based himself in Atlanta, Georgia. And unlike some Weather Channel veterans I could mention, and maybe I will here in a bit, he is not a climate change science denier. He's also the author with Nick Walker of a somewhat satirical new book for kids, The World of Thermo, An Unfortunate Release, which he describes as a children's climate primer set for publication in early November, just in time for the holidays or for the apocalypse, depending on how you may look at it. Guy Walton, welcome to the Bradcast, sir.
Well, thank you, sir, Brad.
Good.
That was a very good summation about Florence so far. far.
Oh, good. I didn't get it terribly wrong. We'll get into some of the specifics.
Not at all.
Oh, good. But hang on. Let me ask you, before we actually get to the specifics on Florence, because I know we're going to talk about that, and I want to talk about whether you're safe there in Atlanta. But on yesterday's broadcast, Guy, I noted that there are currently five named storms surrounding the U.S. right now. Hurricanes Florence, Isaac, and Helene, and tropical storms Paul and Olivia. But looking at your website last night, guyonclimate.com, that number doesn't include Typhoon Mangkhut, which is a huge Category 5 that just slammed into Guam. Now it's heading to the Philippines and Hong Kong, and three other storms that have yet to be given names, but which could turn into tropical storms or hurricanes at any time now. So my question to you, Guy, 9 different hurricanes or potential hurricanes across the globe at the same time, is that normal for this time of year or ever?
I don't believe so. With the ocean heat content rising and atmospheric content rising, I do believe that you will get more potential energy for more storms. And that's one point we'd like to go over with. Yes, as you get more heat, you'll get more storms, and that's exactly what we're seeing. So that's one sign. And just to let you know, Brad, I believe that we're going to have subtropical storm Joyce out in the far North Atlantic, named by 5 p.m., at least 5 p.m. my time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will make 4 just in the Atlantic Basin alone. And if you look at the Gulf of Mexico, there could be a potential fifth. That would be, I guess, named Kirk. And that would be coming into the Gulf of Mexico or affecting maybe Texas and Louisiana over the weekend as well, if that gets named. And by the way, if we have 5 simultaneous named systems in the Atlantic Basin, that would be a record.
I saw that storm. Looks like it's actually a pretty big one. Again, non-meteorological eyes, but in the Gulf of Mexico currently, I think it's labeled Invest 95L. I'd love to know what Invest stands for, by the way. I don't know, but that should be, you think, potentially rolling in by the weekend to Texas?
Yes, probably as a weak system. Really, all these systems are much, the other 4 systems would be much weaker than, of course, Florence, which is the main concern. And as to your other question, an Invest is just an area meteorologically that looks very favorable for development. It doesn't really have a closed-off circulation at the surface, and if it did, it would become a depression or a labeled depression. But these areas are tropical waves that look like they'll be coming, for example, into an area of a favorable development, and that's pretty much what the case is with the Invest system at, currently moving into the central Gulf of Mexico.
Now, one more before we get to Florence here. Hurricane Olivia, which is, I think, now a tropical storm Olivia, that is set to hit Hawaii very soon, if it hasn't already hit. This is just about 2 weeks or so after Hurricane Lane dropped record rainfall on the islands as the second worst rainfall in recorded U.S. history after Hurricane Harvey in Texas just last year. Olivia is said to be weakening but picking up speed, and this would be the storm's movement itself, not the wind. Again, not a meteorologist here, but that sounds like potentially good news for folks in Hawaii regarding Olivia?
Yes, I don't think that we're going to see devastating effects from Olivia. It's definitely not going to come in as a hurricane, and although I believe that we'll see some local damage from flooding from this, maybe some damage from winds from about 40 to maybe gusting to 60 miles per hour or so. Right over the central Hawaiian islands. Now, what's so unusual about Olivia is that it's coming in from the northeast. And if you want to put some climate change perspective on these systems, is that what you look for are parameters that are unusual. And it's definitely rare for any tropical system of any significance to affect Hawaii coming in either from the east or in this case, northeast. What Olivia did was actually go north of, due north and northeast of Hawaii, mm-hmm. and then start to recurve down from the north. So that's very unusual.
Seems like we're seeing a lot of unusual weather patterns of late. The opposite appears to have happened with Florence as far as picking up wind speed, yet the storm slowing down itself off the eastern seaboard over the last day or three. Which of those two things, the winds intensifying or the speed of the storm itself slowing down, should we be most concerned about at this point, or specifically folks in the Carolinas, Virginia, and where you are now in Georgia? What's the greatest concern from this storm, if that can be quantified?
Well, meteorologically, the greatest concern is the slowing of the storm and stalling right off the Carolina coast or right around Wilmington, and then very, very slowly moving south or southwest back towards Charleston if it gets down that far. And so if that's the case, like Brian McNulty mm-hmm. is saying, you could have winds and waves for many, many hours, if not for two or three days, just lashing at the shore. And that could produce more damage than, say, a Category 4 Hugo, which would be moving in and out. And by the way, you may not know it, but I was in Hugo in Charleston in 1989. And I was young and a little, of course, young and brash and very, very inexperienced about that sort of thing. So a buddy and I from the Weather Channel decided to hop on the road, go down to I-26 to Charleston and get on the outer periphery of Hugo. And we thought it would be going up towards Myrtle Beach, or at least the forecasters did at the Weather Channel. And lo and behold, it went right up through... through Charleston, and I did get to see an eye of a 140 mile per hour hurricane, and was in that for a good 5 to 10 minutes, and nearly lost my life from that little thing. But that's a story in of itself.
Yeah, I was going to say you were wet behind the ears at the time, but maybe that goes without saying.
I was 27 years old at the time. So. There we go.
And in comparison to Hugo, which was 89, how does this storm look different several decades later? Or does it look a whole lot like Hugo?
Well, it did, but we have had some good news, and it looks like there's been some degradation of the eye this afternoon. Mm-hmm. Not that there's a slight chance that it might come back, but really, in my experience, when these things start to degrade as they're approaching the coast, even though they might be a day or two away, they usually don't go way back up to, say, Category 4 or 5, or high in 4, low in 5. And so that's probably what's going to happen. It will probably come in as a 3, so at least initially it's probably not going to set the records that many writers and people were saying, oh, this is going to be the farthest north 4 coming in, or... that sort of thing, but the unusual thing about it is that it will stall, and usually these things usually move northeast. They don't move southwest or west along the coast. So as my other buddy Bob Henson was saying, if it does move west or southwest, that would be highly unusual.
And devastating, and that's sort of what's being now predicted, that move to the south and southwest. The predictions a day or so ago had landfall for Hurricane Florence happening on Thursday morning, and then it became Friday morning. Now it looks like Friday night or even Saturday morning, and now actually even I saw Sunday on some of the models, the latest I saw. Is that what you're seeing, and what causes a storm like this to slow down? This was apparently at one point quickly moving, but now it's slowing down. And why are we seeing so many slower storms like this in recent years? I'm thinking of Superstorm Sandy, of course, Hurricane Harvey, Maria, and this all means hugely increased rainfall. But why does it happen? Why do we know why these storms seem to slow down the way they're doing of late?
Well, let's see. First of all, let's get the meteorology correct. The only two storms of note that I know of that actually really did slow down were Harvey and, of course, now Florence does that. He has yet to do it, but would be Florence.
Mm-hmm.
But what really makes them slow, and also we have some scientific papers coming out about this indicating that tropical tropical cyclones are tending to move slower, are what we call upper-level ridges or heat domes. And when these, initially in the deep tropics, hurricanes or tropical storms are over these things, but as they move up into middle latitudes, usually they find their way into an area that can steer them at least moving at least slowly or ejecting. And Harvey, it didn't happen with Harvey at all. That was a poster child for a storm slowing down because of a warm, I call them global warming heat dome sometimes when they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so strong,
mm-hmm.
and you don't usually find something like a 597 decameter heat dome out in the northern and central Atlantic. That was at least it's breaking down now, but it was steering Florence in the direction that it's moving. And then, of course, you have a midsummer type heat dome. So you would find something typical like that in July and August over the central of the country, which mm-hmm. is going to be blocking it from moving from the other side. And so the only direction that the thing can go would be either west or slowly, very slowly, northwest and then due north. And it may take it all weekend long into the early part of next week to just move from, say, the Savannah, mouth of the Savannah River or the Georgia-South Carolina line all the way up to, say, Asheville, North Carolina.
That those blocking patterns that you seem to be referring to, as Desi Doyen here calls them on the Green News Report, these blocking patterns, are these attributable in and of themselves to global warming and a warming climate that then those big the fronts of warm air end up affecting those hurricanes and making them more dangerous and disastrous? Is that all what we should expect in a climate-changing world at this point?
In one exact word, yes.
And I appreciate that exact word, because I want to, you know, your guy, a meteorologist, as I understand it, not necessarily a climatologist. I'm right on that?
That is correct. I was trained in meteorology, mm-hmm. and I've been... I graduated in 1983, and then joined the Weather Channel the same year, and didn't really start thinking about climate until I heard about James Hansen's testimony before Congress in 1989, and it was not even on my radar, to pardon the pun there.
Right.
And then I became more and more interested in it during the 1990s. And then I started to get so mad at some people at the Weather Channel that I started to track just record highs versus record lows itself, starting on a level. Let's just do something new for the millennial.
Mm-hmm.
At the crack of 1/1/2000, I started doing that, and then it became a geophysical science study back in 2009.
And that sort of brings me to my question here. And I, of course, don't know what happened with the folks at the Weather Channel, but my question is sort of, why do so many meteorologists, versus climatologists, but meteorologists, and specifically broadcast meteorologists, it seems, even after going all the way back to James Hansen, as you mentioned, in the late 80s, yet they still seem to have, all these years later, such a difficult time connecting these extreme weather events to climate change. And yes, that even at the Weather Channel, where famously one of its founders, John Coleman, has become one of the most famous climate change deniers on the right. What's up with that? And what would you attribute that to, as you've been working for all of those years in broadcast media? Why is that the case? Why do we see that from so many what I will call weathermen and women?
Well, Brad, I'm going to give you maybe an answer that you might not expect.
Okay.
When I was going to school, I loved to see a very different... I think we all got, as young people, we all wanted to become meteorologists because we loved weather. And we all like to see what we like to see. We like to see, in my case, snowstorms and ice, rare stuff that we used to get in Atlanta where I was growing up, and became interested in that. And then, of course, the mighty hurricanes, and then, of course, heat waves. So we got into meteorology school either to become broadcasters or, in my case, a behind-the-scenes synoptic weather person, liking to see, for the most part, cold weather phenomena. And if you think about global warming in the long run, you are going to see less and less of that, and it sort of threatens your sensibility as to what you may or may not like. And I find it very ironic that also that a lot of synoptic meteorologists, for whatever reason, have a lot of libertarian views.
Hmm.
And so we've had to actually study hard and work pretty hard ourselves with no help. And that's part of that, too. So people in general like to see what they like to see. And if anything's threatening that, well, then the denial part comes in.
Is there a pressure that you have observed, and I've just got another minute or two, and I want to ask you about your book, but is there a pressure that you have observed, again, in the broadcast media regarding, well, you know, these oil and gas companies put a lot of money into advertising. Do those commercial pressures come to bear on some of the reporting when it comes to weather, whether it's, you know, local media or even a place like the Weather Channel, or is it just attributable to some other factor that they don't seem to be often connecting the climate change dots, which seems so apparent to the rest of us who pay attention to this stuff?
I just don't think so. Not to my knowledge. I mean, I'm pretty sure that some have been influenced by the big oil and gas giants, but I think it's just a threat to personal paradigms. I really think that's what it is.
Interesting. Guy Walton, before I let you go here, new book coming out for kids, The World of Thermo. An unfortunate release. We'll try to talk about it after you publish, I guess, in November. But very quickly, give me an idea what The World of Thermo is about.
Well, all my life I've wanted to try to educate young people about climate, or not all my life, or since the 1990s. Mm-hmm. I was thinking now, okay, how could it pique some young person's interest about the more scientific and quite to be honest, dull world of weather and climate to people who are really not interested in it.
Right.
And what better way to go through the route of a little superhero type character, because most kids are interested in pictures and comic books and neat storylines and Harry Potterish type stories, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that this book is going to be that as good as that.
Right.
But, by the way, it will be titled Thermometer Rising instead of Unfortunate Release.
Okay.
When we get it sound. But anyway, so Harry Potter, Thermo is this little flying thermometer that flies around at the whim of its creator to gather up climate information, and he starts encountering all these different natural monsters like hurricanes and other things, and both his creator and creator's name is Dr. Key, discover as Thermo matures a bit that things are not as they seem, and greenhouse gases are changing things. And Thermo's arch nemesis is Carbo, a big invisible beach ball type carbon dioxide model. And Carbo wants to influence human beings such that more and more greenhouse gases, or his friends, so to speak, are released. So we have a little tete-a-tete with those two characters throughout the entire book, which gets a little complicated, but nothing more than a 12-year-old child can understand.
Our friend, Dr. Michael Mann, who's been on the show many times, atmospheric scientist, says about World of Thermo, one of the great ironies of human-caused climate change is that those who had the least role in causing it, our children, will bear the brunt of its devastating impacts if we fail to act in time. He says it is urgent that they be educated about the threat and that their voices be heard. He says World of Thermo uses engaging magical characters to bring the science alive and inform while entertaining. We will look forward to that book coming out in early November. Guy Walton, a 30-year veteran from the Weather Channel. You can find his work on the web at guyonclimate.com, and you can and should follow him on the Twitters at climateguyw. Guy, really appreciate you joining us today. Hope you'll not mind if we bother you again to join us in the future.
Well, thank you so much, Brad, and you can actually call me what I like to be called by sometimes on my blog. It's the Climate Guy, so there we go.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a subset of Bill Nye, the Science Guy, by the way. I'm one of his subsets. So.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Climate Guy. Please stay safe out there in Atlanta over the next few days as this storm rolls in, and stay in touch, my friend.
Sure thing.
Okay, quick break. And we got just a few minutes left here, but I want to talk about climate change, even as a huge, monster, very scary storm is bearing down on some 10 million people on the East Coast. A few thoughts on that when we come back. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
Don't talk about the weather.
Shh. It's a military secret.
Just keep your wits together.
Shh. That's the safest way to keep it.
These are critical times.
Yep, welcome back.
Be careful on
SBS. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I'm seeing news flashes coming in that Hurricane Florence is growing larger, threatening a wider area, even as there's been a slight decrease in the wind speed. You know, I was talking with Guy Walton over the break. The big concern here is really what we could see as record flooding. He mentioned like record going back to colonial times, but
yeah.
We don't have records going back really to colonial times. So really, this could be worse flooding than anyone has ever seen in North Carolina, though not worse flooding than anyone has expected in the Carolinas.
Yeah, one of the things that is important about the statistics on this is that Florence is already geographically larger as a storm than Hurricane Hugo was. But we can assume that there are lots of folks who live there now who have not experienced a major hurricane even since Hugo.
Well, one of this column by Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Daily News caught my eye last night, because we had been talking a few days ago, Des, about North Carolina and how they had essentially passed a law to make it so that public officials, public documents could not talk about sea level rise. That was essentially barred, banned from, public documents and reports, et cetera, literally by law. This was back in 2012. Will Bunch notes that the state enacted a law that essentially outlawed a report that had been commissioned by the state, warning of sea level rise, warning about a huge swath of area that was threatened, particularly by storms like this and the storm surge that would come in with it. He said it essentially outlawed the report and barred state officials from using its findings to make coastal development decisions. In other words, they could not use the science that the state had commissioned when they were making decisions about developing up and down the coast there at this, on this very expensive real estate right on the ocean, which frankly, for those people who did build in that area over the past few years, they may be regretting it in the next few days here, depending on what happens with Hurricane Florence. But he goes on to note, if you live in North Carolina, South Carolina, or Virginia, you should not be reading this column. You should be boarding up your home and protecting your valuable possessions before you protect the most valuable possession of all, yourself and your family, by evacuating to higher ground. He says, however, if you don't live in Florence's immediate path, this seems like the perfect time to look up from the rotating red blob on your TV screen right now for a few minutes to talk about A, why storms, floods, and droughts are setting unthinkable records for their intensity, B, why in America it's been such good politics to embrace such bad science, or, more accurately, no science at all, and C, what are we going to do about this climate mess once the damage from Flo finally ebbs? He says, of course, many readers are going to say that now is not the right time to mix weather and politics because hurricanes and wildfires are becoming the mass shootings of the climate change debate. Well said.
Wow.
Where saying anything in a moment of crisis beyond offering our thoughts and prayers to the afflicted is crass and inappropriate. But he says thoughts and prayers won't help the mostly underprivileged residents of the low-lying Carolinas any more than they saved gunshot victims in Parkland. The reality is there's no better time to talk about failure to take climate politics seriously than on the eve of a natural disaster that global warming has made worse. So this state now, several states, North Carolina, South Carolina, North Carolina, for Christ's sake, had a governor who was headed up a coal company, an energy
yes.
company, Duke Energy,
yep,
for
Christ's
sake.
He used to be the CEO of Duke Energy for something like 25 years.
They've got all of these open pit coal ash pits, toxic coal ash pits, that are wide open, that are likely to flood,
and could
almost
also,
certain to flood, I would think.
And they will flood. They will take on a lot of water, and a lot of them have the potential of collapsing. Their impoundment walls will collapse, could collapse. That's putting that toxic metal, all that radioactive toxic metals into the water supply.
There are nuclear plants, about six nuclear plants or so in the path of this storm. You know, if we don't talk about it, if we don't talk about it now, I promise you we're not going to talk about it after the storm blows through, because we don't. We obviously, well, you and I do. We do.
Right. We talk
here
about
on the broadcast and on the Green News Report. But,
right.
You know, otherwise, as Guy Walton said, oh, well, you know what? To a lot of people, it's kind of boring. And I guess it is kind of boring. We try to make it less so. I don't know if we succeed or not in our efforts there. But, you know, we have to be yelling and screaming about this, because this is not going to get better by itself. It is going to get worse. It is going to get worse almost no matter what we do. But the number of storms that we have seen slamming into this, not just this country, but all around the world in recent years, it's getting worse and worse. The storms themselves are getting worse. It's not necessarily the number of them, but the intensity of them.
And remember, this storm, this particular storm, and all storms are also taking place on higher rising sea levels, which means that the baseline for storm surge has moved up. A case in point, the Navy shipyards in Norfolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Norfolk now floods on a sunny day just with high tide.
Yeah.
So with the billions of dollars in military infrastructure alone down in Norfolk, Virginia, that's in danger not just from storm surge today, but from sea level rise tomorrow and in the decades after that. So when you are making your decisions for who to support for your representatives at the local, state, and national level, remember that we need to plan ahead for these impacts that are now baked in, the ones that we can't do anything about now. We can mitigate the impacts somewhat by transitioning to clean energy, but there are some things we can't stop, and we need to be preparing for those now.
Yeah, Will Bunch notes that down in North Carolina, they have seen an unprecedented level of sunny day flooding as well from high tide, some 84 days of it in Wilmington, North Carolina in 2016, with the pace of those events accelerating. And he also notes that, you know, the response from North Carolina politicians, including then Democratic Governor Bev Perdue, she was the one who allowed that law that essentially banned the use of science in North Carolina back in 2012. She didn't sign the law, but she allowed it to become law without her signature. You know, the response has been to attack science. On the very same day that Trump was warning Southerners to evacuate from Florence's path, his regulators at the EPA were preparing to side with industry by making it easier for oil and gas drillers to release methane, which is a huge cause of a very dangerous greenhouse gas, a huge cause of rising emissions and rising heat into the atmosphere, which melts the ice caps, which raises the oceans. And we're back here. He says that will make the planet hotter, making the oceans warmer, making the next hurricane even stronger, making the next presidential evacuation tweet even more urgent. The same could be said of other recent ill-advised and arguably insane moves from the Trump administration, like weakening emissions rules for cars, emissions rules for power plants. He concludes by saying maybe Florence will be the one that finally causes the tide to turn, that causes our future climate policies to again be informed by sound science and not political demagoguery, because thoughts and prayers don't work any better on hurricanes than they do against AR-15s.
Mm, wow.
We'll keep talking. And until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, weather guy, Guy Walton, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of our show or any other today, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks and the Twitters. I am The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again. Please stay safe out there. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.